Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus and I welcome you back tonight to Mythic Atlantis, a series that we've had on before many times throughout my career as a podcaster. But first, the legend of Hercules. Since Plato first penned his foundational works, many a tale teller has spun a fantastic yarn of long ago times and set in ancient Atlantis. One of the most recent was a television series that explored the lost continent through the lens of Greek mythology. Epic heroes like Jason and Hercules, along with historical figures like Pythagoras, adventure in a land not unlike Minoan Crete and revisit familiar legends. Though unseen, Poseidon remains an all-powerful presence. Alas, the series was not renewed for a third season, which is unfortunate as it was leading to the voyage of the Argo. But the two-season adventure is now immortalized on streaming platforms, Blu-ray, and DVD. Episode 11 of the first season, Hunger Pangs. Penniless and hungry, Jason partakes of a sacrificial meal laid out for the goddess Hecate. As a result, he grows increasingly more lycanthropic each night. Pythagoras finds a cure in an ancient scroll. It requires silver and a return to Hecate's temple. Alas, Jason may not survive it. Hyptarion aggressively hunts the wolf. Ariadne is in danger. Pythagoras comes up with the concept of clocks and kills someone with a statue. The extent of Pasiphae's perfidy is further revealed, and Jason is cured. Episodes 12 and 13, which are the end of the season, Touched by the Gods, Part 1 and 2. Circe demands that Jason fulfill his vow and pacify, or his friends will suffer. He attempts it, but finds that he cannot complete the act. Ariadne assists him with escaping. Minos is at death's door. Ariadne's faithful servant is a minion of the queen, and the princess finds herself convicted of treason and about to be burned alive in the belly of a bronze bull. Aside from the mythic trio, there are others who serve Poseidon, Atlantis and the king, a warrior, a priest, and a seer. Together, they rescue Ariadne and help her escape. While on the run, Jason meets his father, Aeson, though he remains unaware of it, and we discover that Pasiphae is his mother. He remains unaware of this as well. Two villains meet their ends. Minos is restored to health and reunited with his daughter. Life returns to normal for our heroes, and Pasiphae learns from the oracle that her son, who like herself is touched by the gods, is destined to someday destroy her. Dun, dun, dun. Then there's a featurette behind the scenes, which is very informative and introduces the creative minds that brought us Atlantis and the techniques they used to make the unfolding tale truly memorable. Fresh from their success with Merlin, also on the BBC, the epic production team mined the rich mythology of ancient Greece and combined the adventures of several heroes into a much longer and much tighter epic narrative. This is well worth watching if you enjoyed the show. And now onwards to our own Mythic Atlantis and adventures. Greetings to Setna and greetings to Pamela. How are you?
Hello.
I'm doing great. How are you?
Hello, Pamela.
I'm doing fantastic. Hi, Pam.
Hi.
How are you?
Sleepy, actually.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you both for stepping up to help relaunch Mythic Atlantis. And I guess we'll start with Atlantean memories. Sedna, do you remember Atlantis?
Of course.
What
it is in the mind. And quite a bit of the hieroglyph in Egypt. They talk all often about the sea people. But I have past-like memories myself as some kind of a student to a philosopher. And I have visions often about standing in front of a huge mercury mirror and looking into this, quite a bit the way Nostradamus did into the black bowl, and being able to give vision, kind of like Olympia, to the case of Apollo.
Oh, wow. And Pam, how about you? Do you remember Atlantis as well?
I remember some things of Atlantis that I was for at least 7 lifetimes involved with the library there. It was a huge, huge building. Its walls were divided in half horizontally. The lower half was like brass. The upper half was just like white stucco. There are many, many places to go. It's in the library. It was huge. I think of the biggest library you've ever known, and it was at least 10 times that. I had people who were my students, and we had actual books like we know nowadays. The time of the scrolls came later after some of the libraries were destroyed, and they were all over the world, actually. There was one in what we call the Caribbean, and there was one in Portugal, in the southern part of Portugal, what we call Portugal now. I was involved with several colony libraries, and we took a lot of copies to each one of those. And unfortunately, the only one left is hidden in the northwest of Venezuela in the Amazon, and is not approachable at this point in time until someone of a specific caliber can prove that they are worthy to approach it and enter.
Pamela, my name, when we worked together when I was an apprentice, my name was Kannos, A-A-N-N-O-S. I was a young man, and I met you, the great philosopher, great teacher, and it is you that brought me to this liquid mercury mirror and made me stare into it so I could see past lives, present lives, and future things. It is an interesting thing that when we were journeying back home, I saw this. I didn't say anything at the time because we were too busy getting home, but I saw this. Well, it was quite an adventure, but we did manage to make our return fine. But Kannos was my name. I think that I died quite young, and you brought me back, which is even interesting. But I had no memory of who I was when I was Kannos at the time, which brought you great sadness. I'm sorry. But my brain had been dead too long.
Wow, well,
the Egyptians knew a lot about brain surgery.
Yes,
and that came from the libraries of Atlantis.
Hmm. But again, my physical brain was dead too long. After 5-10 minutes, even the best surgeon can't revive you.
That's true.
And so you buried me in a, I would say this, in a glass tomb, a crystal tomb, and I've not been found yet. And you preserved my body many, many centuries later. Egyptians found what we were doing. The priests of Anubis suddenly understood how to mummify.
I'm glad you guys connected again in this lifetime. And
it
that we're all working together towards bringing back the echoes of the memories of Atlantis and the here and now.
It is important. It is essential that we do this now because we are at what's called the crossing in the age of Aquarius. The time of the crossing is when the stars will all cross. It's beyond what the pagans call Samhain, where the veil is thin. This is more the metaphysical, I'll call it, more than a doorway, a metaphysical passageway that will open up for us now that we're all uniting and coming into each other's consciousness and coming into each other's understanding of each other, that we can reach into each other's brain. Pamela can reach into my brain very easily. she's quite
good. Now, let's not give away our secrets here.
don't mind.
It was
it kind of tickles.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you have a pleasant experience with that. Telepathy kind of does work in that way. But it's a different kind of telepathy than people know about.
Well, when one is not open to these things, it may be painful. Kind of like a Mr. Spock's mind meld. It's not a pain. It's not a pleasant process. But you and I can enter each other's energy fields, and that's how we got home, Pam.
Indeed, as Spock would say.
Oh, yeah.
So my memories are, I have a lot of memories of Atlantis. The two that are the strongest in this particular lifetime are when the earthquakes first started. I don't remember Atlantis disappearing in a day. It happened over time. And there were earthquakes in the beginning and tsunamis and things like that. I remember belonging to a royal household, and my father, although it's not clear in my memory whether he was my physical father or a spiritual father in some way, he was a priest of the sun. And he was dressed in a way that's more reminiscent of South America than of Europe or North Africa, although there were elements of that in him as well in the Temple of the Sun. And I had some ritual functions to perform, but I wanted to stay with the people because the people were, pretty upset over the earthquakes and there was a massive loss of life. And I listened to my father and I went to perform my spiritual duties. And the area which was mine to protect wound up under the waves, after the earthquake. So I was very upset. I was very angry. And I remember turning away from the way of the sun and, going forth beyond Atlantis into Europe and North Africa. And that incarnational choice stayed with me for very many incarnations, so I worked my way through it. And the Atlantean priest of the sun or sorcerer, whatever way you want to describe them would be accurate, he was a spirit guide of mine when I first started waking up in this lifetime and remained my primary guide for many years. And then I had another life where I remember being a native of North Africa. And I was a guard for the Atlanteans who were migrating to the Mediterranean after, some of the major catastrophes. They were leaving the area. I remember the boredom of being on guard duty for many hours and, listening to these people who I resented on some level. But they were the masters, and they're coming brought a lot of building projects to Egypt that were inspired by the Atlanteans. So it was a very busy time. Culturally, it was a very rich time. But they were not very nice to their servants. So, again, I have more memories, but those memories are disjointed. These two, I remember lots of instances from these lives and long stretches of time.
Well, I will tell you this. When I died, Pamela took my essence, my spinal cerebral fluid, whatever it was, and she put it in a bell jar. And she escaped, and you remember this, Pamela, in a balloon. The island is sinking. Let's take to the sky. And she did. She took all these vials of people's, I'll call them memories, thoughts, their essence. And she took these things. And she found bodies that had landed on the shore from the earthquake and the tsunamis and such. And she found these bodies, and they were dead. And she knew that if she injected into the pineal gland these memories, that we'd have bodies again. And that's exactly how she and I went back to work. And I remember that. I remember waking up and looking in the water and not knowing who I was. And she said, "You're Thanos, wake up," in a very demanding tone. And I said, "Yes, master," without even knowing that that's who I was. And we walked onto some kind of a beach. I'm not sure where. I'm going to tell you, I think it was in
either Sicily or Crete. But after the great disaster happened, she carried my mind in that vessel, my mind, my spirit, my essence, and these beautiful stars. And if that were known today, we wouldn't have death at all, honestly.
Do you think that would be found? There's a lot of people investigating death in our society, and they're making strides in slowing down the effects of aging and extending life. Our lifespan now is more than double what it was a few centuries ago.
Did you notice on that note, actually, the last, I'm going to say 20 years, people are dying younger again. Many, many people are dying in their 40s, 50s, and 60s that might have lived into their 90s.
That's the topic of another show.
Yes. But here we go. Pamela, do you remember carrying those vessels?
I honestly do not.
Oh, you'll dream about it and you'll see it.
I probably will. Thank you so much.
Let me ask both of you. How do you feel we can best serve the memory of Atlantis? Atlantis serves as an abject lesson to the abuses of technology in some respects, and also the effect of greed on the environment, which we're seeing today. How do you think we can take the message of Atlantis and provide corrective measures and hope to the people of today? Because a lot of Atlanteans incarnated, especially within our lifetimes, there's been an influx of Atlanteans.
Particularly in the 50s, that's true.
Yeah.
Well,
memory of Atlantis is more than what happened in its last days. The Atlantis I knew was very peaceful and had a golden era to it. And it was only when the shadows started appearing, when the earth started to rotate into night and day instead of just day, that these problems started coming. And that was at least 25,000 years ago. And possibly even more. I was at the very beginning of Atlantis when it was founded by the later Lemurians. And the sign of the MU, the Mu, was for Lemuria to give to the Atlanteans, for the race of humanity that was evolving, was becoming a little bit denser than that of the Lemurians. And the first Atlanteans experienced what we now call nerves. And it was then that the mystery school of developing a physical body started to take place. And probably the very first Hercules, long before being a son of Zeus as an archetype, came to be. And it was that which has continued so many thousands of years later in what the Greeks call the gymnasium. It is hard for me to pull these things forth because they were so long ago.
The gymnasium, gymnasium is where we get the word gymnasium from. It literally means a place where you go to be naked. And it's still to this day in Greece, high school is called gymnasium. You know, so it lives on in terms of what a high school is called in Greece. And here it lives on as where you go and work out. And the earliest Hercules that we have history of are Melkart, who was in the Anath cycle. He was one of the Balin or the Elohim. Or he's still an Elohim. He's still recognized as one of the creator gods by many of the theosophists. And the periods that you're describing are preserved in Theosophy and in Rosicrucian lore as well, with Lemuria and the descent into matter. And that's a very interesting area of study. And I have memories of all those times as well. And my making my peace with the Temple of the Sun was the path of Heracles, you know, because he's a solar avatar. So the path of initiation is now remembered as the labors and it's the zodiac. Those are all part of the mysteries of the earliest Hercules.
The energy that I came into was through Ra. Was an Atlantean. Ra was a very high Atlantean priest. And when he flew and he landed in what would be called Heliopolis later, in the center of the middle of the Egyptian desert. And he started to erect a temple. And, of course, you had very primitive people there. And he brought them language with his two guides, Ptah and Tehute, or Thoth. And they were his two grand vizier and great advisors. And they brought these things. And then the rest of the ships landed. And they started to tell people about things. And all of a sudden, you had a civilization in Egypt. And we're talking about at least, well, according to Dr. John Anthony West, at least 25,000 years ago. And you had, all of a sudden the pottery changed. There was language. There was people building huts. From huts, I mean, building, block, wood, mud brick houses, and then stone houses, and suddenly roads, and learning about agriculture. My spirit energy at that time entered a man named Azar, A-Z-A-R, later to be deified as Osiris. The whole story of Cain and Abel came from this time. Now, I have an interesting memory. I am standing on top of the roof of my palace with my wife, Aset, who is Isis, and we are celebrating our birthdays, having a grand old time, and the guy Setos, or Seth, came and he destroys us. Well, me, he doesn't destroy Isis. But the whole thing became a mythology and what have you. But she, through magic, revives my body and makes me the Lord of Eternity. So I become from a physical being back into a spiritual being, which is what Pamela is talking about, where we didn't have bodies. We were just etheric beings that didn't bother to manifest into a physical form. I have a guide, and I've told you this. His name is Soran Siti, and he also never, never had a body. And he began in the celestial library, which is what Pamela has been talking about just all this time. The great celestial library, a library that, yes, it had books and things, but it's not on this plane, and that's why we can't find it. Very much like Shambhala and those energies which the great Tibetans have brought forth, too. Would you not agree, Pamela?
We can all three of us travel those planes.
Yes, of
course. In this lifetime.
Well, we've learned astral at very young ages, have we not?
Those libraries are still available. My group, when I had one in northwestern New Jersey, we met monthly. We used to travel to one of them. They were like, we used to call them the libraries of Thoth or the libraries of Hermes, or the Akashic Records, they're sometimes called. And you could access all sorts of information. And we visited there quite often. And my group from then, who's still involved with what I'm doing now, they want to return to visiting the libraries and all those other places we discovered through our astral projections and guided meditations and journeying and all the other techniques we were learning.
Through Soran Siti, I do transmedia work, and I'm able to go, or that is part of he and I together, come and do things where we enter what he calls the Book of Life, which are also calling the Akashic Records. I have amazed people. When I was in, I think it was first year of college, I ran into a doctor whose name was Dr. Ted Bennett, a parapsychologist. And he didn't believe it, you know, and all this stuff. He was on and on and on. And I went into a trance state, and Soren Tsitsi came, and Dr. Bennett asked him about a recent past life of his, which he knew nothing about. Soren Tsitsi told him he died as a World War I ace. He died in France. He told him the man's name, and then the spirit left. Well, Dr. Bennett, being a skeptic, went to look it up. And sure enough, in that part of France was a tombstone with that man's name on it, exactly the date that we had said it was. And he came to the, I remember coming back to the college the next day, white as a ghost. And he said, how did you know that? And I said, I didn't. My higher self did. But from then on, people were asking me about past lives and such. And it was very interesting. And he also was able to, and is able to, help people with what's going on in their current situation. But I take this, that Soren Tsitsi is definitely a name he uses as an Egyptian, which is, you know, favorable to my energies, but that he's much older than that, and probably a star being to begin with, before even coming to Atlantis.
Now, now that we've shared a little bit about our memories of Atlantis, let's go to the present. We're working together. We're going to remember a lot as we work together, and a lot of the puzzle pieces, we each have a little piece of puzzle, will connect and will become something to give us a greater understanding. Right now on Facebook, in our Mythic Atlantis Beyond the Pillars of Hercules group, we have 446 members. And let me describe what that's all about. Mythic Atlantis Beyond the Pillars of Hercules is an exploration and celebration of lore about Atlantis, mythological, scientific, historical, speculative, anecdotal, personal, occult, extraterrestrial, metaphysical, psychic, cinematic, graphic, and fictive. It also serves as a resource for those who wish to protect the world's waters and the life forms that live there. In addition, it serves as a pronos for and a gateway to our Olympian tradition. The adventure begins in two of Plato's books, the Timaeus and Critias, and continues here in this group. And this used to be a public group until recently, but I found that people who weren't members of the group were posting pornography in the group.
Oh!
Yes.
Ouch.
So I kept deleting and warning, and it didn't stop, so I just made it a private group. So now you have to apply for membership to get into the group. And I brought back the podcasts. This is going to be the first one that's continuous, but I've done a lot of specials over the years. And I'm going to be working with Disclosure Network. They have some people who have been investigating Atlantis. One of them went out with boats around Bimini. And we have Lynn, who is in charge of the Edgar Casey Foundation in New York City. She'll be talking about Edgar Casey in Atlantis. And I have a bunch of authors that I've contacted. So we're going to have a lot of people, again, providing pieces of the puzzle. And I'm sure many of our other hosts remember Atlantis. So we'll be mining their memories as well. And I feel that by doing this, a cohesive narrative will begin to emerge. And what we're here to do in terms of the Atlantean aspects of it will become much, much clearer. For now, in addition to just basically exploring the legends and the memories and the metaphysical information about Atlantis, also Atlantis in the popular culture, because a lot of information is transmitted through popular, you know, culture, as you both know. And the Atlantean information, even though it differs in detail, it's still remarkably consistent. So we'll be looking at that as well. What responsibilities would you guys like to take up in the group? I can make you both moderators, and we could work out some sort of schedule where, because each of us is different, and we have different gifts that we could bring to the group to help evolve it.
I would like to be involved with helping people with astral projection, because I'm rather adept at that, and also trans mediumship, because it's something, again, I do quite often, and also having people find their past lives where they can connect with not only recent past lives, but far into the past where they will connect with their Atlantean lives, which I'm sure they have. Well, they wouldn't be following us.
I think that will happen. I wanted to just say quickly, when I lived in Florida, I took a cruise to Bermuda, and I went to Bimini. I saw the I'll call it the road, the wall, and I got the craziest feeling that I remember it falling. I knew I was there when it collapsed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was an amazing feeling. And I have crystals that I brought up with me from the water, which I will never let go of, that are extremely powerful, that have the power of memory in them. And I would share those with the group also.
That is fantastic, and I like your ideas, so let's schedule those. And this is going to be a monthly show, so
right.
That's definitely something we could start focusing on. And Pamela, how about you? What are your thoughts?
Oh, my. I am not sure I can bring the same kind of gifts that Setna can bring. I've always been interested in Atlantis. I perceive Atlantis often enough, but not all the time, from various mystery school writings, the Western mystery schools more than the Eastern. I'm not sure what I could bring in terms of teaching stuff.
Well, how about the connections that you mentioned? You were a librarian in Atlantis for several incarnations, and
yes.
According to Setna's memories, you were an adept, and you were knowledgeable in information that could transfer a consciousness from living bodies to dead bodies. That would be very helpful to somebody studying deep trance mediumship and also astral projection, in that there is a transfer of consciousness. So I'm sure you know how to do that deep within. Do you also astrally project?
All the time.
Okay,
I just don't think of it as any kind of talent, though. So, you know, it's just I do it, and I just know how. Having to put it in, you know, analyze it and break it down, I'm not sure I can do that because I synthesize things rather than analyze them. I pull things together instead of breaking them apart. Do you understand?
Yes, of course I understand.
Okay.
So each of us has a way of describing what we do, but essentially we all do this practice. So how about we devote the next show next month using astral projection to visit Atlantis? How does that sound?
Excellent. I would like to help by doing a guided meditation, which will help us all do that.
That would be fantastic. Pam, what do you think?
I'll help in whatever way I can. Just have to let me know what it is I can do. Because, like I said, I just do things naturally because I can.
Right.
I've never been educated into that. A lot of the Western mystery schools that I have been affiliated with have taught me some of these things that I can understand how I do what I do. But there are things that I just brought with me from ancient Atlantis that are in my superconscious, and I just know these things. You know, all you have to do is ask the right question, and I have the answer.
So it'll take us a little while to do this dance, but I'm committed to doing it. So. And the reason I'm using theosophy is a vocabulary, and we'll find this too, that in the beginning what we're saying will kind of sound disjointed and jumpy, but as we learn to communicate with one another and we adapt each other's words and concepts, the communication will become very clear and smooth. So theosophy is a language that's been used since Blavatsky brought it forth into the light of day. But also in antiquity, theosophy arose during the Hellenistic era, which was around the time of the Greeks, the Egyptians, and the rise of the Romans with the early Caesars. There was a lot of cultural interaction happening. And earlier than that were the Phoenicians, or sometimes known as the Sea People, and their routes of sailing, which encompassed not only the Old World, but also the New World. And there are artifacts that demonstrate that. And some of their deeds gave birth to legends that are echoes of Atlantis. So we're going to be spending more and more time, and not only in terms of history and physicality as we understand it, but into the esoteric memories that are preserved, which speak of the days when we were etheric beings or etherean beings, and before we took on flesh and lived in the material world. And I've met a bunch of people, like, including Setna, who remember the dinosaurs roaming the earth and interacting with the dinosaurs. So our lives go back much further than our descent into physical matter. And there's a lot of esoteric information which was obscure and introduced and is now lost or survives in PDFs on, like, esoteric websites.
We are considered Aultet, Aultik. That is the primeval matter of primeval matter. And that is, I've taken that from hieroglyphs. For some strange reason, the ancient Egyptians decided that this carrier of this was an egg, a divine egg that was laid by a male goose, which makes no sense. And however, I think the goose was a ship, a spaceship, and it laid, quote unquote, an egg. It's actually probably, if you think about it, like the capsule when Apollo or what have you, when they all landed again. Just that little extra capsule, even though those are kind of triangular shaped, think of it as an egg. And we came out of it, I think.
We'll be looking at the ancient astronaut aspects of it and the folkloric and the mythical aspects as different descriptions of memories. This is going to be a fun adventure, and it's going to lead to interactions with other areas of study as well.
I see that happening as well, very much so. We're all kind of all part of the same fabric, and it's going to make a wonderful quilt when we're all together.
I believe that as well. So,
oh my.
Describe, since we're going to do astral projection next time, describe, I guess, as an introduction to astral projection, how you astrally project. With me, I immerse myself in whatever it is I want to conjure within myself. I'll immerse myself through books, through movies, through meditation, through any way I can in terms of the time and the place I wish to my consciousness to go. And then through journeying, shamanic journeying, astral projection, lucid dreaming, regular dreaming, wherever my consciousness finds itself, I navigate to where I want to be, and then I experience things there. Sometimes the things I experience are pretty much in tune with our reality, the way things are here, except in a different time and place. And sometimes, like in dream, they're highly symbolic, and the experience becomes a metaphysical type of experience that's rich with symbolism. So I find that, again, it's something that I could do pretty much all the time, and it doesn't depend on my being in any particular state of consciousness to do it. I can do it with wide awake. How about you?
When I was in junior high school and high school, during study hall, quote-unquote study hall, my teachers accused me of daydreaming. I wasn't. I was on an astral projection. I just left my body wherever I was in class or the library or the lunchroom, did whatever I had to do. And I knew I was conscious of the time. My projections at that time lasted about 15 minutes, which seemed like years because in that time, the time is different. Now, I have a new friend who, of course, is Oliver, my new cat. And he has been very, very helpful in helping me travel into the astral planes. Apparently, he's very good at it. And he's only 7 months old, so I know that he's a soul that has come back to help me. He's kicking me. He's like, shut up, don't tell him everything yet, Michael. Well, right now I'm not Michael, I'm Setna. And Comwest Seth Mekamwes is a consciousness from a very past life, but he's come with me. Well, I was Seth Mekamwes 4,000 years ago, and here I am back. Ta-da! You know, I mean, I didn't have the success King Tut did, but, you know, I don't think he reincarnated. Actually, I will tell you that there are certain prime beings. Tutankhamun did not reincarnate, despite what Victor Bono did in Batman.
That was great, by the way.
Oh, it was so
have
cute.
You ever, have you ever seen the TV series Stargate Atlantis?
Yes, of
course. I have all the episodes.
Yeah, me too. It always intrigued me. You know, every TV show has a, quote, Bible, and they have researchers. And it always intrigued me how they got so much that they could base, you know, on this Atlantis thing. How they could bring it to sort of life. But stargates were the key to that. And there are portals throughout the galaxy that can be used. We call them stargates because we don't know what else they are. And the one in Cheyenne, Wyoming, that they had initially in the Stargate episodes, they discovered more and more of these around the Earth. The Earth is key in some sort of evolutionary project, I think.
Well, we have one right here, and that is right at the Metropolitan, actually around the block from the Metropolitan Museum. You have Cleopatra's Needle, and it's not the obelisk that gives it the energy. It's where that was positioned in the park. There's some kind of a vibratory field that obelisk acts as a focal point, a gathering point of energy, because after all, that's basically sand and limestone. It's not, you know, it's a rock. It's not really gathering energy, but it's the vibration that's below that rock that's giving that energy there. And I've done many rituals there, and you'll find the compass of north, south, east, and west, the energy vibrates so strong there that you can go into an astric state where you're going to go into a plane I call Avicii, where you're going to reach out beyond where we are and go into where you were and where you will be all at once.
That's sort of why I'd like to get the two of you down to Adams County here in Pennsylvania, because there's a space-time warp there, and I'd like for you guys to experience it and tell me what you think about it. Now, those are my stomping grounds, as I like to say, because I've been in and out of that thing, and I've seen stuff that shouldn't be seen. You know, not that it's bad, but it's just there are people living in that thing that sometimes reappear.
I'm being told to move south, although everybody wants me to stay up here. I feel very strongly that I may end up back in North Carolina. I don't know. My mother came from Greensboro, but I feel like there's an energy there either in the Carolinas or in Georgia that something is calling me to come down there and use my energy there. And maybe it's because Hercules is north and you're west, and we have to find an east. Somewhere there has to be an east, and I think I'm south now. And those
that's
magnetic
interesting.
Yeah,
that's an interesting
magnetic
way of looking
fields.
At it.
Well, I think that those magnetic fields need to be addressed. I do.
There's a time anomaly in Tenafly as well. I was calling it the Tenafly time portal for a while when I first started investigating it. And Tenafly means 10 swamps. And the ancient there were 10 swamps here once upon a time before the settling that took place and the development and the filling in the swamps. But in Greece, they knew that swamps were often gateways to other worlds. And swamps had their guardian monsters, like Cerberus prevented the dead from leaving the underworld. The Hydra, for instance, was a guardian of a swamp that led to the underworld. So I've been looking into that on and off for years now. I've been here for about a decade. And so there's a weird anomaly here as well.
Well, you've also got out on Long Island. You have a I don't know if you know this, You have a bottomless lake. It's called Ronkonkoma. It's not a man-made lake. What happened was a meteorite hit Long Island about a million years ago, and it went straight through to the other side of the earth. It's like a hole, a black, a kind of a vortex. And if you go into that, you go to that lake, feel it. There's a humongous magnetic field. I live two blocks from it, and I was grateful to get away from there. It used to give me humongous, horrifying headaches because I knew the magnetic field was drawing me in. There's a story about a Native American priestess who literally walked right into the middle of the lake, and she was in a canoe, you know. The whole thing just vanished, evaporated. That she got to the point where that magnetic field was, and literally her whole person was like, beam me up, Scotty, and poof, she was gone. She didn't sink. She didn't go down. She just disappeared. So
wow.
We know that that is a very strong vortex. And my teacher and his uncle and his father were in a canoe in that lake, and the uncle fell off the boat. And yes, he was drawn down. They never found a body. They never found his Uncle Michael, never. Poof, gone. He
we
fell below
collecting
the water.
This lore, because there's a lot of lore that doesn't get collected. I used to have a regional folklore society in Pennsylvania, and here when I first moved back to Jersey, we had the Society for the Study of Living Myth, which collected these stories, and we used to publish them periodically when we had the website. So we should start collecting these tales again, because otherwise they'll be lost.
There was a man who loved to go to the library in New York City and to the one in London. And his name is Charles Fort, and he collected a lot of the oddities. And I have a couple of books of his that have unexplained things in them, and perhaps I can re-explore those and see what I come up with. Maybe nothing, maybe something.
That'd be great. I used to be a Fortean. I belonged to the New York Fortean Society, which was hosted by John Keel. John Keel is the one who gave us the Mothman. He was the one who published the book on Mothman.
I have some of his books, too.
Yeah, he was great. I miss him.
Well, there's a lot of other energies out there. You know, there's a whole thing about, I don't know if you've been reading, but about the Toltec people before the Olmec and before the Aztec. That those people had those, and before the Mayans, the Toltec had all these amazing petroglyphs and hieroglyphs that they wrote. And these people, they say, went back into the sky, but the whole tribe left these beautiful pyramids and beautiful structures and statuary and vanished. There's no trace.
Yeah, I've heard about that. Yeah,
they weren't killed; they just vanished. Poof, gone. So
Joshua Gates, as an explorer in Expedition Unknown, has brought some of that into his series, Expedition Unknown.
And then there's that, I guess it's a plateau that is like I'm going to say the base of a temple that's in Japan. It's in black basalt and also made of black quartz.
Oh, yeah. He covered that too.
And this thing is too perfect to have been created by nature, and they have no clue. There's no language. There's nothing on it, but it's at least 30,000 years old.
Wow.
And whoever made it just left. Hello, goodbye. You know, we know that Stonehenge in England is on top of something that's much, much older. They just discovered there's some kind of a material. The English government won't let them get in there too much, but below the stars and stones and below the main altar area, it's some kind of a magnetic field that is drawn by lodestones. but it's a whole solid circle of lodestone laid flat and polished. They've seen it on, what do they call, spectrograph? Is that what it is? The one that can go below the ground?
I believe
so. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, they've seen this thing. It's like a gigantic disc, and it's below Stonehenge. And it's very, I've been to Stonehenge. It's another place that I got a headache. That and in the Great Pyramid. I was fortunate. In 1988, I was visiting with a person who was going to produce a film I was working on the Pharaoh Akhenaten, called Keeper of the Sun. And we bribed some people to stand guard, and I slept in the Great Pyramid, in the sarcophagus.
Oh, very cool.
For about 2-3 hours. It was hot as hell, and it smells terrible. But I did get into an astral state, and I did know that that sarcophagus was not anywhere ever meant to be to bury anybody, but that was an initiation chamber, I'll call it. That I felt that very strongly, and a very strong energy with connecting with the stars and the sun, and also the spirits that inhabit that pyramid. And they're not human. They're much, much older.
I'm looking at the clock. We have less than 10 minutes. I'd like everybody to share contact information. I'll just end by recommended reading. I am putting together a recommended reading list. One is basically Plato's Timaeus and Critias. The other one is Edgar Cayce on Atlantis. Atlantis and Diluvial World by Ignatius Donnelly. And then there's the Emerald Tablets with an S of Thoth. There's the Dweller on Two Planets with Philo the Tibetan. That deals with Atlantis and UFOs and things like that. And those are actually the most fundamental works if you want to enter into Atlantis studies. Because Cayce and Donnelly did more to put in the popular imagination. And then the other two books, in terms of occultists, are like foundational.
Do you know about John Anthony West's Serpent in the Sky?
Yes.
That might be something to consider at another time. Very complex.
I read that years ago when it came out, I remember.
I did too. 92, I think it was.
I might still have a copy somewhere. That's a nightmare journey of looking through tons and tons of crates of UFO books. But if I have it's there.
When I see you again, I have it. I keep it out.
Okay.
I have my reading list, my Egyptian reading list, and I keep those. But Serpent in the Sky is not necessarily just Egyptian. It is very much Atlantean.
Okay. I will refresh myself on that book, and I might add it to the list. I was thinking in terms of starting something.
Oh, cool.
Go ahead.
No, my cat was going to fall off the bed.
Oh, okay.
He's sleeping. He rolled over.
Murray Hope. Murray Hope is not accurate.
Nope.
And she makes up what she puts out there. But how, even though she makes it up, it's very true to the source, the spirit of the source material that she's creating magical systems for. So I was thinking of making that part of the required reading list. She wrote three books on Atlantis. One of them I put in our lending library. I put whatever is not available freely online, I put in the lending library, and the other texts online, I'm putting links to them. So that's why anybody who wants to read them can do so affordably. That should be done by the end of this month, the entire reading list.
Her ancient Egyptian magic, practical Egyptian magic, is very inaccurate. I did use it because of the structure of a group and certain other things, but all her colors are wrong and all her prayers are kind of off the wall. She's kind of like Herodotus. She heard things or she gathered information, and it's like you said, she made it up as she went along, which I don't really like.
But it works pretty good. Like, I used to practical Greek magic, again, for groups. In northwestern New Jersey, I used it. Continuously,
yeah.
In Pennsylvania, I used it. But I would let people know that this is the spirit of it, but in terms of it being very accurate or even reflective of what they actually did in antiquity, no. But for somebody who's approaching it from our culture, it's a good first step. And then later on, you'll wind up disproving all of it, but it still opens the door to learning in a fun way. So until I find something better, that's my the magical text for the group. And I'm sure once we incorporate, before we had human forms, we'll have some interesting Rosicrucian books. There's a Rosicrucian book on Atlantis and Lemuria. I forget who wrote it, but a Mork published it. Pam, do you remember?
Max Scheindel.
Okay. Yeah, that's a very good book introducing it. And some of Blavatsky's stuff, like the stanzas of the Book of Zian and things like that, touch upon that time as well. So we'll come up with a library for that. And I'm sure some of this is in the public domain now. It's been very many years since it was written and published. How can people contact you and follow what you're doing individually?
Well, I always tell them, pjfernsler@outlook.com. Nobody takes me up on it, so it's still out there.
But people do talk about you. I have people who listen to the show and some other hosts who ask, when's Pam coming back on? So you do have an audience. They might not want to talk to you directly, or they're not ready to talk to you directly, but you do have an audience.
Okay, and a reminder, Hercules, that Artemis is waiting for her appointed time.
Okay, we will do that on Zoom, because Zoom, I have a lot more flexibility with scheduling Zoom things than with Block Talk Radio. So, okay, we will discuss that this weekend and set up part of the time for Artemis.
All right.
And Sedna, how about you?
Okay, very simple. You can get me at Michael K. Waterman on Facebook. You can get me M.K. Waterman at iCloud.com. You can reach me on my phone, 516-650-3691. You can get me, I think it's Makeup for You and More on Instagram. Actually, my Facebook and my Instagram are linked, so that's easy enough. And you can also get me through you, of course. I'm waiting to now be able to get people to go. I will be on MNN in February to start.
Awesome.
We got kind of a late start. They also had technical problems.
Yes, the age of information seems to be plagued by technical problems.
MNN, I was just going to say quickly, MNN has some very archaic equipment, and that's part of the problem.
Well, thank you to both of you. This was a great new beginning. And thank you for stepping up and wanting to take responsibility for this project. And the next step, I guess, is let's prepare for the Astral Projection and Atlantis show. And let's ask our other hosts if they have any Atlantean memories, and let's see if they're interested in sharing them as well. And onward, the adventure continues. Thank you. I wish you well. Have a wonderful long weekend, and I will talk to you both very soon.
Okay.
Thank you, Hercules. And good night, Pam.
Thank you.
To see you.
Okay.
And thank you to a wonderful audience, whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you dialed in and you're patiently waiting in our queue, or whether you're going to check us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Good night, everyone.
Good night.